Hi again, everybody. Professor Mintzberg is on his way. He'll be here in about 1 or 2 minutes. We've been trying frantically to inventory all the skills of the steering committee, and we have a pianist and no piano. And I really can't sing, so I will start today's session just by introducing myself. As I said before, my name is Patricia, and I'm chair of this year's Management Forum Committee. And on behalf of everyone on the steering committee, I'd like to welcome you to the 2012 program. This year, we've chosen the theme of neighborhood. We moved away a little bit from the idea of community because a neighborhood is smaller and it exists inside a community. McGill is a community, and as managers, we make up something of a neighborhood. We're a social unit that interacts, and we work together for common goals. This year, we'd like to explore some of those ideas, look at our roles and responsibilities, and think a little bit of what it is to be a manager here at McGill. So with that, I'd like to welcome you once again to the program. And as soon as Dr. Mintzberg arrives, Kathleen Ng will take over the session and will be our chair today. Thanks a lot.
Sarcasm. That's my talent. Now, as you notice, there is a little card that's going around that the SEED office, and Veronica, you're here? Yes, stand up and bow. I know you get embarrassed and don't like doing it. Veronica's in charge of the SEED office, and she is doing a community engagement day on Friday, October 5th. So come out and join it. And in advance of the community engagement day, dentistry is also having a community engagement run on the mountain this Saturday. And what they're doing is they're trying to raise money to run their outreach program. The outreach program is a mobile dental unit in a van that goes out to the streets and gives dental care to people on the streets who can't afford it, and also gives a first curiosity look at their health and see if they need anything and refer them to hospitals or whatever. And they run on a very tight budget, and all the money is raised by the students through this run and a few other initiatives. So if you get a chance, go to Outreach for Dentistry. They have a website. You can pledge money. Every dollar counts. Or you can come up on the mountain Saturday morning and watch the Dean of Dentistry run 5K, 10K behind all the students. I understand he came in second to last year. The dog came in last. But it's a good initiative, and it's nice to see the students being so engaged and out there and trying to do something for the community. And they also give their time for this event. They go out 3 or 4 times throughout the year, out onto the streets with their van. They work 14, 15 hours a day. They also go down to the Welcome Hall Mission and set up a dental clinic down there. And they're trying to expand to also set up a dental clinic in homeless shelters and shelters for battered women to help them. So if you get a chance, go and take a look at it. And Veronica, remember October 5th, Veronica, where is this showing? Where do you find this?
So I invite everyone to look at the website. It's written on the postcard, communityengagementday.com. We have 500 volunteer opportunities on the 5th, and you can look at all the projects and sign up on the website. So we encourage all students, staff, faculty to take part. Thank you.
One other thing, when Professor Mintzberg gets here and he does his speech and you have questions, make sure when you finish your question, push the red button. Otherwise, you're going to get reverb and you're going to block other people out from talking, which may not be a bad thing.
Hi, everyone. We're really sorry about that. Can everyone hear me? Okay, good. So my name is Kathleen. I'm actually one of the students from IMPM, which is one of the managers, not MBA's programs that Henry had pioneered. And I'm sure that all of you have probably read some of his books and some of his works. And if you have a chance, I should definitely recommend you come into the program because what he's going to say is going to rock your world. So without any further ado, Henry Mintzberg.
This is from Alec. A gift for you from Alec. Swiss. I'm sorry, I had a mark for 4 o'clock, but I'm not too late. I mean, I'm too late for 3:30, but but for some, I think we shifted times, and somehow didn't get, I have a new iPhone, and somehow it didn't get recorded or something, so here I am. Wait, I'm gonna, got too many things in one pocket. So, I'll put my cookie here. I was gonna look at this in the 10 minutes I had before I, because I prepared this a couple of weeks ago. I've been at McGill for 44 years, and it's hard to believe. I started when I was six. No, actually. So I kind of know it. I know it from the faculty point of view, and I think there's two quite different worlds in McGill in one respect. There's a, at least when we're talking about community and communityship, which is a word I prefer to leadership, because I think we put much too much emphasis on leadership, and not enough emphasis on building sense of community. I'm not talking about McGill in particular, although I think McGill is somewhat included, and I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm talking about organizations in general. I think we inherit. I think in Canada we're not so. We haven't been in, so intrinsically obsessed with leadership the way the Americans are. But we get a heavy dose of that, and we buy into it. And so we tend to overemphasize leadership the way the Americans do. I think the Americans are so obsessed with leadership because they get so little of it. I'm being quite serious. Any chief executive who accepts to be paid 300 or 400 times as much as anybody else in the company, or at least as the workers in the company, in effect saying, whether he or she means to or not, in effect saying I'm 300 or 400 times more important than you are, is not a leader. Okay? That means that there are, in corporate America, among the largest corporations, there's maybe a handful of leaders by that definition. One is the guy who owns Costco, but he doesn't have to be paid millions because he owns Costco. But there are very few who don't accept that. And essentially they're sending out a signal, sending out a message saying, I'm that important. That's not leadership. In fact, I think certainly there are situations where organizations need to be turned around by very, very strong leaders when they're bankrupt or in deep trouble. But mostly what they need is the encouragement of the sense of community that exists in almost every organization. It may be dead or dying, but there's always from the origin some sense of community in organizations. I remember working with one large, we had in our program here, one very large American corporation, well-known corporation, that was going through a hard time and not dealing very well with all its problems. And the people came on that program, particularly the ones from middle management, were tremendously devoted to that place. It was a family business. It built up as a family business. It had a long history. They were very devoted to it. And even though they were jerked around a lot, please don't read sort of editorializing about McGill and anything I'm saying here. I'll get back to that, or we can get to it in the questions. I just think it's pervasive across so many sectors, but particularly the business sector. There was something left of community, and I think there usually is. Organizations we admire most usually have a very strong sense of community. And in McGill, I think that's quite strong. I think it's stronger among the faculty, from my perception, than among the staff for a number of reasons, although I know great numbers of people, non-faculty people at McGill, who are incredibly devoted to this place and believe in it in very special ways, including people who have been on contract for decades, 1 or 2 year contract for decades. I just don't think that's acceptable. And I've told people that. I realize all the reasons for doing that. I just don't think that's acceptable. When people commit so much of their time and devotion and energy and belief to a place and every year sign a contract or every 2 years It's not how you build community. But that's the way things are these days, not just at McGill, but everywhere. Although my hope is that McGill doesn't have to, the best of McGill doesn't do things the way they are. The best of McGill does things the way it believes in. And it's maintained, in spite of being an underfunded English university in a largely French-speaking province, McGill's maintained an incredible sense of scholarship and of quality. That's quite remarkable. I remember reading when McGill was ranked quite high a few years ago, as it is every year, on the Times of London thing, rating. And it was 18th or something that year. I think it was the same or similar this year. And it was rated the top public university in North America. Oxford and Cambridge, which were higher, would have been public universities by that assessment. And I'm not sure McGill is technically a public university, but it was called the top public university in that rating. And that means ahead of Berkeley, ahead of Pennsylvania, ahead of University of Michigan. I mean, that's quite impressive. And if you put that, I've never seen these figures. Maybe somebody put them together. But if you put McGill's ranking in those ratings against its funding, it's probably the most efficient university, maybe in the world, or in the developed world, but certainly in North America, I would think. I haven't seen those figures, but somebody probably has those figures. If you think of the organizations you admire, leave aside universities, even think of corporations, think of anything you like, you may admire them for their products, like Apple and so on, but largely you'll admire them for the sense of community that exists in the place. People are devoted to the place, they believe in it, they have strong feelings. Gore Tex, that makes Gore Tex, is a company that sustained that kind of belief system for a long time. And it's essentially how its people are treated, how they believe in it, what sense of mission exists in the place, and so on. So what I really want to talk about, McGill's an old-fashioned university, in a way, in the best sense of the term. We haven't been as co-opted by all the forces of commercialism and everything else that so many universities are, and including some of the best ones. I mean, Oxford gave the name of its business school, it's actually second. It had an initial business school, which was more executive development, and then it created a kind of degree-granting business school, to a guy who was rumored to be an arms dealer. He insisted on controlling the board of directors or the board of advisors of that school. He insisted on controlling them. Finally, Oxford fought back. And wouldn't give him a majority, but it literally gave him a number of seats on that board. And The Economist concluded that Oxford's all screwed up because they don't realize that everything has to be run by a business, like a business these days. And I wrote a comment on that saying, no, somebody should tell The Economist that there are universities and schools that have to be run according, run for the sake of education, and not like a business. It's also very fashionable to copy everything in business. So we've got to do strategic planning, and we've got to do, Six Sigma, whatever it is. And I'm not putting down any of those techniques. They may be appropriate, or they may not be appropriate. But we can't ape business for its own sake. There are plenty of things that business does that just don't work very well. And we can start with strategic planning. There's no such a thing as strategic planning. You don't. Nobody plans strategy. People create strategies. They learn their way into strategies. They invent strategies. They don't plan. Nobody's ever planned. A strategy is not about analysis. Strategy is about synthesis. Synthesis doesn't come from a planning process. You can call it a process and go up and think about strategy and come up with a strategy, but these kind of highly organized processes don't give you strategy. In fact, universities are very interesting when it comes to strategy because they're completely different. Universities and most organizations of professionals like hospitals, consulting firms, and so on. Strategies come from the bottom, in a sense. What's strategy? To a lot of people, strategy is your position in the marketplace, to use a business sense. It's your products and your services made available to which users. That's what strategy is. Well, then what's McGill's strategies? Well, it's an MD program for people who want to be physicians, and it's an IMPM program for senior managers who want to study management, and it's an arts program for people who are interested in, or a theater program for people interested in culture, music program for people interested in music, and so on and so forth. And it's all those research things that go along with that. So McGill's product market positions are a whole bunch of programs and a whole bunch of research projects. That's the basic strategy or set of strategies at McGill. Where do those things come from? They don't come from our administration. This is not a criticism of our administration. They come from individuals on the ground who are coming up with things. Like we developed the IMPM in the Faculty of Management as a kind of new program to challenge existing MBA programs that Kathleen knows well about. And it came from the ground. It didn't come from the dean or the principal or vice principal, although they supported it and they saw the value of it and they helped in all kinds of wonderful ways. I should say as an editorial comment that we always had in this and several other new, very innovative, different kinds of programs, we've always had total support of the senior management of this university. Dealing with some people in the administrative staff in certain spheres has been a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. I won't name names, but it's been an absolute nightmare for some people because that's not the way we do it. Well, that's not the way we've done it all the time. This is a program that doesn't run, you know, for 6 months or a year or 5 years, 4 years full time. It's a program that runs part time. It's a program where people come in temporarily on 10 or 12 day modules and go back. It's just a different kind of program. And we have managed to do it sometimes over the dead bodies of some people who just want it to be exactly what everything else is. So that hasn't been pleasant, but happily we've always had the support of the senior management and of lots of people in the administrative staff positions who have just prevailed over some of their own colleagues in some cases. But that's getting off the topic. So as I said, if you think of the organizations you admire most, whether it's in business or healthcare or anything else, so you see a place where you walk in and there's energy, there's commitment, people feel they belong to the place, they're devoted to the place. I call that communityship. Leadership, to my mind, is important largely to the extent to which it encourages and supports that sense of community. Because when people all over the place are really devoted and concerned, they just do wonderful things. And those are the organizations we admire most. So, and how do you tell sort of community? You tell it by artifacts, right? We look at symbols. So we look at that symbol, and there's a kind of feeling. We did something in our programs with managers coming in from both healthcare in the IMHL, the International Masters for Health Leadership, and the IMPM for business. We get them to bring in artifacts of their organizations. We have people in the business program, for example, who have come for as many as 17 years from companies like Lufthansa and Panasonic and Fujitsu and so on. And it's amazing. We sit in a circle and do a workshop where everybody shows their artifacts. So somebody from Rio Tinto will hold up a big hunk of rock and say, we all have this on our desks, or Alcandil, show a little piece of aluminum, and they'll show it, whatever it is. And it's we call it show and tell, kind of like kindergarten kids with show and tell. And it's amazing how engaged everybody becomes. Like, people really sort of love their artifacts, love the symbols of their university, and it's special for them. So that's what community is all about. Also, a sense of history in these kinds of organizations. In our case, it's all the symbolism of James McGill and the fur trade, and McGill's so tied up, particularly with Montreal's history, and to some extent, to a great extent, Quebec's history and Canada's history. So there's a sense of history, and that creates a certain pride in the place, and a certain uniqueness. Is Miguel unique? You know what? I want to ask you. We have what till about 5:30 Take 5 minutes with two or three people near you. We'll do a workshop. The way our programs work, by the way, what makes our programs unique is we don't our master's programs I've been talking about is we don't sit like this. We sit at round tables in a flat classroom so we can do workshops all the time. So in that class, I would say, let's do a workshop. So we can still do it, but just take two or three people next to you, or in front of you, or behind you, whatever it is, and ask yourself, what's really unique about Miguel? Just 5 minutes. Okay. All right. The sort of a buzz in the room is more a sort of a sense of community than me standing up here talking. Me standing up here talking is leadership. You kind of discussing and the energy that you feel in the room when that happens is more a sense of community. Anybody just... We don't need to hear from everybody, but anybody came up with anything you think might be unusual for other people to hear? Ideas about Miguel? Yeah.
nothing like it, certainly in Quebec, let alone anywhere else. It's the location and the campus itself.
Yeah, thanks to James McGill's country house, right? We could move to my country house, only an hour away. Anybody else?
Right here.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Go.
We're the only university where the founder buried on the property.
He's watching us.
Yes, he's watching us.
That's good.
Hi, I'm Kelly from the McGill Executive Institute in the Faculty of Management, and I would say what makes us unique is that we have unique clients that we can serve and create programs for and learning solutions for that actually benefit the faculty itself and the students we have attending the programs.
Yeah, and McGill has a long history of doing things other than degree programs in the community. Anybody else?
Yeah, my little group here has come up.
Where are you?
Well, we're here. Find me. Okay. A little session here, how international our school is, and from all around the world. What a nice mix. Everyone's getting along.
Yeah. And that feeds back to this previous point, which is it's a very international school in a very international city. There's a famous business school, probably one of the best known in the world, in France called INSEAD. And we've had a long, curious relationship with INSEAD because people who want to be in Europe but can't want to come to McGill, and people who want to be in North America but can't go to INSEAD. So we've had people going back and forth and different things over the time. It's a very international place. And that helps us enormously in recruiting. It can also cause problems when people have young kids that they want to educate in English or whatever, but that's helped us enormously. So every place that has a strong sense of community has a uniqueness, and you know, people don't need mission statements to know what the uniqueness of a place is. I've maintained in healthcare that anybody who works for a hospital who needs a mission statement should find a job somewhere else. You know. If you don't know what the mission of a hospital is, you're in big trouble. Let me give you an example of where McGill's not unique, and it's one of my hobby horses. We have a tenure review process, not the process, but the timeline, that's very similar. It became very fashionable in the U.S., where basically in 5 years you're going up for tenure. I can't think of anything that's more destructive of scholarship than that. Because what it says from the day you start, first of all, you come in with a dissertation that's almost finished or not finished, and so you got a year or two to deal with that, and then suddenly you're on this timeline with all this pressure. That doesn't breed scholarship. When I came to McGill, I took sabbatical in my seventh year, and then I stayed another year because I was in Aix-en-Provence in the south of France, so there was no rush to come back to Montreal. And the dean called and said, "Congratulations, you got tenure." And I said, "Oh, that's good. Thank you. That's nice." I have a colleague who prepared a 100-page document to go up for tenure. What in the world does anybody need a 100-page document? You can get a list of publications. You can get teaching ratings. You can get citations. You can get everything you need. So there are times when we're not pursuing our uniqueness, and it's not always good. A network is not a community. Okay, when people sort of get to know each other in a network in a more formal way or a more detached way, my example of a network not being a community is try and get your Facebook friends to paint your house. Okay. Or better still, to rebuild your barn. Can you imagine all the barns 200 or 100 years ago that had never been rebuilt if there was Facebook and all the farmers were saying, "I'm not going to go help rebuild your barn. I'm on Facebook today. I can't spend time rebuilding your barn." So because it was a tradition, right, in the country, when a barn burned down, everybody pitched in. That's community. It's not a network. It's a community. We talk a lot about the social media, but they're networks. They're not communities. Communities are face-to-face. Communities are when people meet and get to know each other and get to care about each other. But we've been downplaying the sense of community for a long time, not we here particularly, but generally. Communist governments don't like communities. The Chinese government still does everything it can to undermine civil society and NGOs and everything, and for good reason. I mean, the reason that the communist regimes fell in Eastern Europe in the late 80s was thanks to two community groups. It started in Poland, and it was driven by Solidarity, the union in Poland. But Solidarity was able to get roots because the Catholic Church maintained a position of strength in Poland, unique, or rather unique to the Eastern Bloc countries. So those two communities were able to drive a wedge into Poland, and then it spread. So the Chinese communists have good reason to fear community, because community is a threat to their omnipotence. They've got all the power, and communities are a threat. Big global corporations, likewise, are not big friends of community. They tend to play them off against each other. And you hear about Canadian mining companies all the time with things they're doing in local communities in Latin America or wherever. And the other factor that undermines community steadily are technologies. Almost all the sort of technologies. When people wrap a big hunk of metal around themselves called a car, many of them become monsters. You get rage. It's sort of, get off my highway. You ever been tailgated on the sidewalk? You know what tailgating is, where a car is right on your tail? You ever been tailgated on the sidewalk? Like, people don't tailgate on the sidewalk because there's more of a sense, not community exactly, but there's more of a sense of personal relationships. We get in cars, we become crazy. The police on the sidewalk can be friends. The police in a car are kind of enemies. There's a distance. It makes a difference. Telephone, same thing. When I arrived in Aix-en-Provence that time, people I'd meet at school, at work, whatever, would come knocking on my door. One evening, there's a knock on the door, and one of the guys is there. And I thought, this is charming, but why don't you call? I had a phone. It turned out it took 2 years to get phones in France at that point. People weren't used to having phones. So they'd knock on the door, and there was a greater sense of community. As soon as you have the phone, does the phone put you in touch? You know what it puts you in touch with? Your ear. Literally. Right? But it doesn't put you in touch with anybody. It takes you out of touch. Can't touch people on the phone. So computers, you know, how many people are spending so much time kind of in front of screens as if this is connection? So, and all this affects us. I mean, all of you probably, and me and a lot of us, are spending a lot of our time sitting in front of screens communicating. But we're not collaborating, we're communicating. There's a quote from a column by Friedman in the New York Times, who asking an Egyptian friend of his about the Tahrir Square movement, and he said it's for communication, not collaboration. We could communicate through Facebook and the social media, but we couldn't collaborate. Collaboration takes small groups acting in communities that drive change. And the real interesting changes, like if you know some of the ones in Montreal, I know there's so many, Saint-Paul Roulant, I'm trying to say on the road, what's it called? Dans la rue, yeah, it's on the road. Dans la rue, things like that, are essentially community organizations. And that's the way we're going to change society, is through communities. And that's how we're going to improve organizations. When we innovated at McGill, probably in anything, but the things I know, we did it because a small group of people got together and drove it through, not because it was a big kind of network connection. But these days, there's too much of the opposite. Almost every time a large corporation doesn't meet its numbers, the expectations of Wall Street, they fire 5,000 people, or 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people. No, I'm not talking about the ones that, like General Motors, that had their backs against the wall and were going bankrupt. I'm talking about companies that still were profitable, like Pfizer, that was still making a lot of money, but not as much as before. Immediately, you fire 5,000 people. You know what it is? It's bloodletting. You know, 200 years ago or 100 years ago, whatever it was, every illness was cured by bloodletting. Apparently George Washington was killed by bloodletting. Everything is cured by bloodletting. In the corporate world today, everything is cured by downsizing. You fire hundreds or thousands of people and that's going to solve it. What it does is it destroys a sense of community, because the people left behind, number one, are working that much harder, because all those people who were fired didn't suddenly become redundant. Like, how come they weren't redundant before that financial statement came out? They weren't suddenly redundant. So what happens when they all go? Everybody else gets loaded with more work. And they're all watching their rear end because, you know, I could be next. You fired the person next to me on both sides of me, I could be next. So I better watch my rear end and not do anything. This is the way we're creating organizations. America doesn't have an economic crisis. It has a management crisis. So many companies, those big insurance companies and banks that bought all those mortgages, were just mismanaged. And short-term views and treating their people horribly. And that's why it's not getting solved. You know, Romney, the wonderful irony is that Romney is proclaiming that he's going to solve the problem. I can't imagine anything more ridiculous. These are the guys who created the problem. These are the sharks who created the problem. And he's parading around saying, I know all about business, I'll solve the problem. They're not going to solve the problem in Washington. Economists aren't going to solve the problem. They've got to solve it on the ground, where companies are mismanaged, where leaders are walking off with huge bonuses and not giving a damn about anything except the stock price. That's where it's going to happen. And as I say, we not because McGill is particularly to be singled out in this regard, but we follow a lot of that stuff. It just becomes fashionable. Another example of that, and I know I'm going to insult several people here, but it's an easily corrected insult. I'm not a human resource. I'm a human being. I'm not a human resource. It's an awful term. I'm sorry. It's fashionable. Everybody does it. It used to be called personnel. People say, well, what are we supposed to call it? I say, well, personnel wasn't bad. Or how about the human being department? How about the people department? And then we talk about human capital, human assets, and brands. People tell me I'm a brand. God, that makes me ill to think, you know, I'm a brand. I walk around with my T-shirt saying Mintzberg. So I've said for years, nobody will ever do it, but I said for years, the first thing we could do is get rid of the term human resource and start thinking of human beings. If you're working in a human resource department, it doesn't necessarily mean you think of people as human resources, but it certainly doesn't help to think of them as human beings. So we could start by changing that ridiculous term. You know, big companies, in a sense, see their people as a collection of human resources. So contrast that with a proper organization that sees itself as a community of human beings. It's a very different way of doing things. So let's see what I got here. I kind of talked about that, so I won't. That I talked about. Let me compare, because heroic leadership is so fashionable, and there are a couple of Harvard Business School professors who have written articles and books about how leadership is so much more important than management. Leadership is jazzy and with it, and management is like, you know, not really, you know, it's the regular stuff. And I think that's a dead awful mistake. Do you want to be managed by somebody who doesn't lead? Would you like to be managed by somebody who doesn't lead? No. Well, do you want to be led by somebody who doesn't manage? Because it means they don't know what's going on. Because it's management that gets dirt under your fingernails. I happen to be a mechanical engineer from McGill, so I think I got rid of it by the time I graduated. I got the dirt out of my fingernails, But management is about knowing what's going on. You know, we live in mortal fear of being accused of being micromanagers. And it's not good to be micromanagers. It's not good to meddle in the decisions of managers who work for you. But the much bigger problem today is macro leading, leading on an abstract scale where you're not connected with what's happening. So let me compare these two. Heroic leadership. Leaders are important people, quite apart from others who develop products and deliver services. Compared with leaders are important to the extent they help other people to be important. Many of you have probably gone to the Jubilation Gospel Choir just before Christmas in St. James Church on St. Catherine. If you haven't gone, go. It's a wonderful evening. And I remember the first time I went some years ago, that place was hopping. I couldn't believe what was going on there. And the guy who was running it, who developed it, there was so much energy in that place. And they weren't getting paid. They weren't getting paid. They were just so fired up and so enthusiastic. And I thought, that's what leadership is. It's bringing out the energy that exists naturally within people, not creating energy, and not empowering. That's another term I dislike. Empowering means you're giving people permission to do what you hired them to do. I mean, if you hired them to do it, they don't need to be empowered by you. Can you imagine an executive director of a hospital empowering the doctors? So, I have now empowered you. Gee, thanks. That's terrific. You know, maybe they could disempower them in favor of the nurses a little bit, but not empower them. So we have all these terms that I think the higher up these managers go, the more important they become at the top. The CEO, this is sort of business oriented, but it applies to a lot of places. The CEO is the corporation. What does top management mean? I mean, what's top? I mean, Heather is on the 7th floor, I guess, but the dean of medicine is much higher than Heather. Much higher than Heather. Dozens of feet higher than Heather. So we use this term, top management, but if you see yourself as a top manager, in other words, everybody's down there, then how can you be on top of what's going on in your organization? You got to get off your pedestal and be all over the place, right? An organization is an interacting network, not a vertical hierarchy. Effective leaders work throughout. They don't sit on top. In other words, they're all over the place. They're everywhere. Down the hierarchy comes the strategy, clear, deliberate, and bold, emanating from the chief who takes the dramatic act. Everybody else implements. If you've had experience in business and you know this kind of vocabulary, you know that whenever a strategy fails, it's always implementation that's blamed, never formulation. It's always implementation. In other words, and why? It's because the formulators are doing the blaming. Like, you dumbbells, we created this brilliant strategy, and you dumbbells weren't smart enough to implement it. Well, if the dumbbells are smart, they'd turn around and say, well, if you're so smart, why didn't you formulate strategies that we dumbbells were capable of implementing? In other words, all the failures of implementation are failures of formulation. But the real failure, as I was implying earlier, is that strategy is not a planning process. It's a learning process. You don't formulate and implement. You try things, test things, do things, experiment, and things grow and they work. You know how IKEA came up with selling furniture unassembled? There was a worker, not even a manager, worker, who had to get a table in his car and he couldn't fit it in, so he took the legs off. And some brilliant person, I don't know if it was him or someone else, said, well, gee, if we have to take the legs off, maybe they do too. That's how they came up with unassembled furniture. But of course, workers were probably taking legs off cars for years. The issue was not just that. The issue was that somehow that message, that organization was enough of a community that that message got through to people who could do something about it. That's the important thing. You know how IKEA got into warehousing? You know, it's one of the few places where you go into the warehouse, right? It even looks like a warehouse, but you go in freely and take your own stuff. They opened a great big store in Stockholm, and they were inundated with people, and they had a conventional sort of desk where people gave little pieces of paper, and somebody ran and fetched it and came back, and, you know, the usual thing. And they just couldn't keep up. So somebody said, take the table out of there, just go find it yourself. That's how it happened. I mean, you can imagine the chaos because it wasn't set up for that. And they would have had to carry chairs and everything out on their shoulders, I guess. I guess they would have had the carts because they had to bring it out anyway. And that's how they ended up with warehousing like that. Interesting strategies grow. They don't, and they grow through learning. They don't appear with very important people sitting in offices thinking grand thoughts. To lead is to make decisions and allocate resources, including, did I read the other side? Out of the network emerge strategies as engaged people solve little problems that grow into big initiatives, like taking the legs off the table. To lead is to make decisions and allocate resources, including those human resources. Managing this means calculating based on facts from reports. Everything's about measurement. Everything's about measurement. You have to go in for a difficult operation, very serious operation. Find a surgeon who's got a high death rate. You know why? Because that surgeon probably gets the hardest cases. Okay? You don't want a surgeon with a very low death rate, because that surgeon probably gets the easiest cases. So you want the surgeon who gets the hardest cases. In other words, beware of measurement. Beware of measurement. We once had a guy come up for tenure, and he was exemplary. He had all the right publications. Everything looked terrific. But everybody on the tenure committee at that point, we were all from different departments, everybody on the tenure committee was like, there's something not right about this. So I said, let's all go and read his stuff. I mean, it's readable. He wasn't in a mathematics field or something. We could all read it. So we all went and read, and we all came back, every one of us. And we said, this is junk. It's just bad stuff. I don't care if they published it in A journals. Just bad stuff. You have to, you know, when I say people should use judgment instead of just measuring all the time, I get these funny looks. And then I say, well, you remember judgment? It's still in the dictionary. You can find the word judgment. It does still exist in the dictionary. But we're so obsessed with measurement. We're so obsessed with measurement. Measurement is fine as long as it doesn't mesmerize you. But it so often does mesmerize you. So we end up measuring everything left and right. You know, it's a popular comment, a popular expression in business, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. But nobody's ever measured management. Nobody's ever measured measurement. Nobody's ever assessed measurement. So I guess we can't manage management or measurement. So we're going to have to close every company down according to that prescription. So beware. Leadership is thrust upon those who thrust their will on others. Leadership is a sacred trust earned from the respect of others. You're not a leader because you decide you're a leader, and you're not a leader because somebody senior than you chooses you to do something. You're a leader because people are enthusiastic about taking your advice and following you. That's why you're a leader. Leadership is given by the led, not by senior people. When Bolton was put up by George Bush to be ambassador to the United Nations, at the hearing, somebody called him kiss up and kick down sort of person. We get too many kiss up and kick down people because the choices of managers or chief executives come from people who have never been managed by the candidates. They don't know what they're really like. They just know how well they can impress outsiders. But they don't know what they're really like. So we end up with people often in that kind of kiss up and kick down situation. If you really want to know somebody's... Look, everybody's flawed. I hate to tell you this. It probably comes as a horrible shock, but everybody is flawed. Even imagine that. Everybody is flawed. And so when we're choosing leaders or managers, we're choosing flawed people. But if we choose well, we choose them according to... So that their flaws are not fatal in the circumstances. That's the important thing. So when you pick people, you should know their flaws. Now, there's only two ways to really know a person's flaws. You either marry them or work for them.
Okay. What is this word,
flaw? Flawed means something that's not... A weakness, like a weakness. Yeah. So you either marry them or work for them. We can't ask spouses for advice on candidates for jobs because if they're still spouses, you'll get one story, and if they're no longer spouses, you'll get another story. But we can ask people who work for them, and it's not a bad idea. I'll leave that one. Okay, the organization is a community. So, what's community? Personal commitment, collective engagement, trust of and by people. That's how you build community. Okay? Robust organizations are communities of human beings. They organize for collaboration and for exploration, more than exploitation. The managers manage and lead. Strategy is learning, and everybody is respected for their learning. In other words, everybody can be a strategist. So that worker in IKEA was a strategist, right? And development happens naturally and cooperatively on the job. So people are developing themselves and developing each other, and that's the way the organization works. So how do you sustain community? You respect the culture. You revere the culture in a certain way, but you're careful about not recognizing the flaws in the culture, because cultures eventually... Cultures never go completely bad, I don't think, but aspects of them need to be cleaned up. Aspects of cultures need to be fixed up sometimes. But respect for the culture, respect for the history is important. A restriction on measurement is important. I'm not saying don't measure. Measurement's important. I'm saying don't be obsessed with measurement. Responsive outreach, somebody mentioned that before, that the organizations we admire serve their communities. They're not only communities themselves, they serve their outside communities, and they realize that without the support of their communities, think of the outreach at McGill, because there's probably no or very few, even hospitals, probably don't have the degree of outreach. Each of us, no matter what we're doing, if you're in admissions, you're relating to all the students who are applying. If you're in the faculty of management, you're relating to the business community. The faculty of law, you're relating to the legal community. You're relating to politicians. People like Antonio Maione are on television all the time for elections and so on. Think of all the outreach. It's not outreach. Antonia doesn't do it for McGill's sake, but she's at McGill, and she does it because she believes in the election campaigns and what she has to say about it and so on. But it's a sense of outreach because she's presented as McGill professor of political science. And among anybody who's doing anything, the people are raising money. I mean, I doubt if there are very many people in this room, maybe people working in information systems or so on, which is more of an internal function, but almost everybody in this room is constantly engaging in outreach as part of their job, or even beyond their job in the sense of contributing to broader things. And then compensation becomes a signal. You know, in Holland, the head of the ING Bank, which is a huge, huge bank, received €1 million bonus a couple of years ago, and there was outrage in Holland. On Wall Street, in the U.S., that would have been considered a joke, €1 million bonus, because it's 10 or 50 or 100. He received the one, he had to give it back. There was so much outrage. So people in senior positions don't take those positions for the money. If the Royal Bank of Canada announced that they're paying no more than $500,000 to their chief executive, do you think nobody would want the job? They'd be breaking down. They'd be battling with each other to get the job because it's the status of the job they want. It's the power of being able to make those decisions they want. Salary is not the first thing. In fact, there's an article just very recently that appeared about the fallacy of having to pay people. I remember my story about this is going back when Margaret Thatcher privatized the water companies in England. And the first thing the new boards did was double the salaries of the chief executives. And there was a huge outcry. And the answer was, we're only paying market rates. Only paying market rates. These same people were perfectly happy to hold that job a few weeks earlier at half the pay. Market rates. It's an old boys' network. It's got nothing to do with market rates. Nothing whatsoever to do with market rates. We've had a kind of a takeover of society by very narrow, greedy interests that are destroying us every which way. That's what I'm kind of working on now. So, let's see. How are we doing for time? I was going to do a workshop, but let's take some questions and see if we have a few minutes to ask you about some of the things. 5 o'clock is sacred, I guess? Okay. Oops. Okay. Questions, comments, arguments, other things. Yeah.
You were commenting on leadership and communityship. If you take an organization like Apple, where you have somebody, like Steve Jobs, who was the leader and built and created that community ship that Apple has, my question is, if you don't have leaders like Steve Jobs, how do you create community ship?
I agree with you totally. I'm glad you brought that up. At the founding of any organization, the leader is typically critical. There wouldn't be a McGill without James McGill. or at least his will. Okay. So McGill was built up by Dawson, really. It was sort of floundering for a long time, and Dawson came up. So usually when an organization builds into something significant, builds into a community, an institution, so-called, leadership is particularly important. The other time leadership is particularly important is in crisis. So Concordia, for example, turned back to Laurier, you know, when it was in crisis a few months ago. So leadership is particularly important in those two circumstances. But typically, especially in an organization of professionals like hospitals, universities, consulting firms, accounting firms, law firms, and so on, leadership is important to the extent that it enhances the sense of belonging. So I'm glad you raised that, because I think those are important exceptions to what I was talking about. Yeah. But now it's going to be interesting. In retailing, by the way, you always need strong leadership, because the retailing is about what goes on in one person's head, about seeing markets. That's why so many retail chains collapse after the founder goes, or Schultz had to go back into Starbucks, and you know, you get a lot of stories like that. Yeah.
Do you think it's possible for a management group to lead itself, and how do they integrate themselves with the existing leadership?
I think I did in a book I did a couple of years ago, I sort of did a range from no management to totally controlling management. I dismissed both extremes. And I said, very significant management, that's exactly the issue just raised. Minimal management, plenty of cases where there's minimal. You always need somebody to turn to, or somebody who can act if things get difficult. Or there always has to be somebody kind of in charge to turn to, but that person may have minimal roles. So physicians, for example, don't wait for the word of the chief of medicine or the chief of psychiatry, whatever it is, to act. But they need the chief in order to, you know, deal with conflicts and deal with budgets and all those things. So you can't dispense with management, but the range of it. I saw a TV thing years ago building a dam in India. And there were 100,000 workers carrying rocks on their heads and throwing it on the dam. And I thought, this is not the place for participative management. Okay. So it varies. It varies according to the skills and talents of the people in the organization, in the unit. But when people, as I say, know what they have to do and just get on with it, you don't need a lot of leadership.
But is that what's happening here now?
In McGill?
Yeah.
Well, McGill's a vast place. So what are we talking about? Are we talking about fundraising? Are we talking about medicine? Are we talking about residences? I mean, we have the whole range. We have the whole range. It depends what aspect of it. In the kitchen, I'm sure they're, you know, in the cafeterias, in the residences or whatever. It's probably, I assume it's contracted out anyway. But, you know, there's not a lot of participation there. On the other hand, pick a new dean in a faculty, and the faculty itself wants to be involved, and so do the alumni, and so on and so forth. So it varies a lot. McGill's a vast place. There's lots of things going on.
You were talking before about data and staff, and I just wanted your opinion on performance dialogue that McGill has.
Performance?
Dialogue that you do with your managers.
I haven't experienced it, so, or maybe I haven't realized it. The dean says that, you know, every year we chat for a few minutes about kind of what, you know, how I'm doing. But I've been around so long that it's, you know, it's not as if he's going to say, I want you to change your behavior. Unless I've changed my behavior and decided that I should be paid and not do any research. I've been half-time at McGill for 25 years anyway, so I just want the other half, I want the freedom to do what I would do in the other. But I haven't experienced it, so I really shouldn't talk about it.
Everything at McGill seems to be done through committees. Do you find that committees help build a community, or do they hamper it in some way?
Yes and no. if it wasn't done through committee, it might be done through fiat. That's not much better, or could be a lot worse. On the other hand, if you just get committed to death, you never get anything done. So, you know, I know the academics best. The academics are kind of interesting because they don't want to cooperate with anybody, most of them. The most outrageous story I ever heard about an academic is a close friend at a business school in Europe. Get this, you'll love this one. And the library was kind of getting tired of people keeping books, especially the academics keeping books for months on end. So it put a six-month limit for the professors, not the students, but for the professors on holding books. This guy wrote a three-page letter of outrage saying, I don't know when I'm going to need the book, and I need it handy whenever I get to it, even if it's more than 6 months. It's the most wonderful, outrageous, absurd letter I've ever seen in my life. Buy the bloody book if you want to keep it for 6 months. You know, but he was outraged. So very hard to get, you know, it's herding cats, you know, the old story. Very hard to get professors to cooperate. But, you know, when we built the IMPM, the IMHL, and those other programs, those are very cooperative programs. I'll give you one measure. I shouldn't talk about measures, but one measure of how we do. I taught for, I don't know, 30 years or something, regular classes. You close the door, you're on your own. Never was anybody, no professor ever came to my class, no dean ever came in my class, my class, you know. And if they did want to come, they would ask permission and explain. You go into our classes now, which are very cooperative and very collaborative among the students and with the faculty, there's rarely less than three faculty members sitting there, and there's sometimes six or eight. And that's not because, and I've got witnesses here, and that's not because they're getting paid. We would go bankrupt if we had to pay all these people sitting in. They want to find out what's going on. They're curious. They want to hear what's going on, you know, various things. So we built an academic program that has a lot of collaboration. And as Ellen well knows, and lots of other people well know, the faculty, the staff, totally work together from beginning to end on everything. And it's an example, I think, of wonderful cooperation. In the we won't give Ellen the microphone, but it's a wonderful example of.
Henry is highly uncooperative.
What's that?
I said you're highly uncooperative.
I'm difficult. Yeah. But do as I say. it's just a different chemistry. And when it comes to anything, I mean, whatever it is we're doing, you know, whether it's redoing a residence or admissions or whatever it is, where you're solving difficult problems, you can't just do it by saying, you know, that's the way we've always done it. So when you're doing something novel, it takes a lot of discussion. That's why these strategies I'm talking about that get learned, I mean, that learning process is expensive. Not necessarily expensive in the sense that it's, you know, high cost, but it's expensive in the sense it takes a lot of time to learn your way into something. But look where IKEA ended up as a result of learning its way into it. Because when IKEA said, all right, we're going to take the legs off our tables, think of what happened. Think of what probably happened. They didn't just one day to the next say, okay, change the catalog. They didn't have catalogs, maybe, or they had different kinds of catalogs. So they probably said, well, let's try it with tables. Yeah, good, we tried it with tables, it works. Well, let's try it with some other furniture. Good, it works. Okay, let's relay out the store so people can do it. And let's have the downstairs so people can wheel trolleys around and pick up all this other stuff. And then let's change the catalog. And then let's provide racks. If you can't get it in your car, you can put it on your car. You can imagine all that went through. And once they got it, wow, they took off. So now, what's that?
Communication and cooperation.
Yeah, whoops. Don't know what happened here. Yeah, communication and cooperation, exactly. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Given that many academics are taking on more administrative and managerial roles within the departments and faculties, what kind of training system should McGill adopt for incoming professors or professors taking on that ownership or that responsibility?
Wow. In other words, how can we teach management to professors, especially ones who are professors of management, because they're the worst? You know, what an awful question to ask.
Well, you know why people go into a field? They don't go into a field because they're good at it. They go into a field because they have dire need for it. So we're professors of management because we have dire need to get organized. You know, and people become psychiatrists because they have dire need to sort of get healthy. There was a guy in the Faculty of Medicine who used to say, I used to be a psychiatrist, but now I feel better. So we, you know, it's the shoemaker, son not being, shoes being shod, you know. So, I think they should, make a path to the Faculty of Management and join into our programs, as some people from McGill have done. Actually, our programs are specifically geared to people who are in managerial positions. We have MBAs, regular MBA programs, that are largely business function programs. They don't teach management. I did a book called Managers Not MBAs, which argued that they give a distorted view of management, most MBA programs. We have the two programs I mentioned. We have the EMBA with HEC jointly. That's very much like the other programs. They're managerial programs. We've developed separately from McGill, but something called Coaching Ourselves. So it's being used in parts of McGill where people can work as teams and develop themselves. So there's lots of things like that are available. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, you talked about measurement.
You should.
Yes, you talked about measurement earlier, and obviously there are instances when it is useful to measure.
Absolutely.
And compare.
Absolutely.
I'm wondering what your guidelines are concerning the threshold. When does it become irrelevant to measure, or where do you see that we should not be measuring?
Well, first of all, we should be measuring what we can, but we have to recognize there are always factors that don't lend themselves to measurement. Okay, and we also have to recognize the biases of measurement. I'm going to ask you if something, I'm going to tell you that something is efficient. Okay, for everybody, this is for everybody. I'm going to tell you that something's efficient. Tell me the first thing that pops to your mind when I say that. A restaurant is efficient. What pops in your mind? How many people thought of speed of service? How many people thought of quality of food? Yeah. When you say a restaurant's efficient, people think service. They don't think quality of food. My house is efficient. How many people think of fuel? How many people think of decor? Did you buy your house because of fuel? Did you buy your house? You bought your house because of decor, because it was close to good schools, whatever it was. Why do we zero in on those things? You know why? Because subconsciously, when I say efficiency, people think measurable efficiency. And so when we get efficient, we often cut measurable costs at the expense of unmeasurable benefits. So Paul Martin, as Minister of Finance, saved us all kinds of money in the healthcare system. Because as soon as he cut the budgets, that showed up immediately. But the chaos that it caused in the healthcare system took years to show up. Because it didn't show up immediately. Okay. So when we get efficient, and when we're obsessed with measurement, we tend to focus on what we can measure at the expense of what we can't. And often, not always, but often, the things we can't measure are critically important. So, of course, measure, but don't be mesmerized by measurement. So if you're saying, yeah, we can save tons of money by cutting the healthcare budget, or we could save tons of money by outsourcing the resident cafeteria because they came in as the low bidder, why don't we give it to them? And then the students start to protest because the food is dreadful, which is a lot less measurable. So anybody who's giving that contract has to be aware that somehow you've got to have an assessment of the quality of the food and not just the cost of the food. So yes, measure, absolutely, but don't get mesmerized by it. Like this guy who had all the right A journals and everything, but when we looked at it and judged it, it was like bad stuff.
I apologize if it's a convoluted, but more and more in marketing for companies, you see that they're looking to create a sense of community to get people to buy into their product. So, For instance, if you look at like fitness companies like The Running Room, they sell products for running, but they also have groups that run together and boards where they give information about upcoming races and that kind of thing. So, and also online, you were talking about the difference between community and network online, and that a lot of the times something like network is trying to pass itself off as community.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my question to you is, if that's a trend that picks up in marketing, are you concerned that it would water down the true sense, the authentic community versus...
Yes. I did a book once called Why I Hate Flying that sold about 12 copies or something, and a few hundred anyway. And it was a spoof about all the nonsense of flying, and one of them was about the marketing people on the airlines scouring all 26 whatever it is volumes of the Oxford Dictionary to find words that haven't yet been contaminated. I mean, the object of advertising agencies is to contaminate perfectly nice words. So take the word community and contaminate it. But we've contaminated so many words. You know, this Facebook thing about, you know, all your friends are buying such and such a product, you'll want it too. It's got to be a particularly obnoxious form of networking. But I don't think people necessarily feel a sense of community when they're brought together for commercial purposes. Doesn't mean they're not, because you could say that anybody who works for a company is brought together for commercial purposes. They can develop a strong sense of community almost over and above their workplace. You know, they become friends, they see each other socially, do things like that. So, possible. I think there was just one other, is that okay? Somebody over there?
Well, mine's more of a theoretical question. You were giving the example of the Royal Bank president who earns $11 million a year and they topped up his pension so he'd get $1 million a year plus his $38 million shares. And they compare, all the other banks compare themselves to the leader of the Royal Bank, so they have to spiral up the compensation for the CEOs over and over. And the poor people at the top, they decide they have to fire the employees, they have to cut the pensioners
in order to pump up the stock so they
give
deserve
him money
those
and
bonuses.
Yeah. So it's very short-term value. Yeah. How can we begin to turn this around? I mean, Occupy trying to protest against the 1% didn't work very much in making any meaningful change. How can we begin to turn this around to respect people and respect the more old-fashioned values?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because that's exactly what I'm working on, and if Kathleen's okay, I can talk for about 20 minutes on just to say that I'm working on what I call an electronic pamphlet called Rebalancing Society, and the subtitle is A Radical Renewal Beyond Left, Right, and Center, and it basically addresses that question. How do we get out of this god-awful mess that we put ourselves into before we destroy ourselves by global warming or by just all the exploitation that's taking place? In a word, I think after 1989, we assumed, after the communist countries, communist regimes fell, we assumed that capitalism had triumphed. But balance had triumphed. We were fairly balanced at that point. Governments were stronger. The private sector was certainly strong at that point. And what I call the plural sector, or NGOs, or civil society, or whatever, was quite strong. The other two have become terribly weakened. The private sector has taken over absolutely everything. I'm all in favor of business. I love great restaurants and airlines that really care and so on. But there's been a takeover by some of the worst kinds of corporations, and we have to challenge that. And in a word, we're not going to challenge it by... Government won't get us out of that problem, because government has been completely co-opted by those forces. Not our federal government. Obviously, Harper is all for civil society, as we all know. But governments have been co-opted by it, and corporate social responsibility is not going to make up for corporate social irresponsibility, of which there's an awful lot more. So it's going to come out of community groups that create initiatives that go around all these forces. The way the Danish people have built so much alternate energy sources in Denmark, and these are community movements, largely. And there's enormous numbers of community movements, and we need more of that. The trouble is, with all this networking, we need face-to-face community movements, not distant network movements, although you can connect the communities. So if some guy in Bangladesh comes up with microfinancing for poor women, and that gets copied all around the world because of networking, but it gets copied in communities in each place. So you can read my pamphlet, which I've been promising on my website for about 3 years. And it's probably going to come out within 6 months or so, I hope.
Okay. Thank you very much, Henry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Henry. I just wanted to thank everyone for coming. There's another group coming in at 5 o'clock, so if I can ask you to very nicely vacate. And hopefully we'll see you at a management forum event in the future, and in the meantime, we'll continue the conversation. Have a great evening.
I think I'm... Thanks, Henry.